From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. Later on today's show, my colleague Kelly Kinnoyer talks with Mohsin Gutabi, UNCW's regional economist, about one of the thorniest infrastructure projects in southeastern North Carolina, a replacement for the Cape Fear Memorial Bridge. Despite years of cautious optimism, it's become increasingly likely that a new bridge will have a toll. Without doubt, that will be unpopular with residents, but what will it look like through an economic lens? But first, it's a conversation with Ray Funderburk III. 3 years ago, Funderburk was thrown off of the Cape Fear Community College Board of Trustees during a high-profile public hearing. Funderburk had spent less than a year on the board, but he'd been the sole voice of dissent on several college decisions. That included a significant raise for college president Jim Morton, a decision that trustees and staff started pressuring Funderburk to support before he was even sworn in. Not long after he was removed, Funderburk filed a lawsuit claiming the college had violated his rights to free speech and due process. Now, 3 years later, the college has settled with him. My colleague Rachel Keith has written about a lot of this as part of her ongoing coverage of CFCC, and this week she sat down with Funderburk to ask what the process has taught him about the college, about challenging established power, and about himself.
Ray Funderburk, thank you so much for joining me today.
No problem. I'm happy to be here.
So I want to start with that the college settled with you. This was over a three-year process for $265,000. And I want to read their statement that they released yesterday on May 4th when we're talking. They say, Cape Fear Community College has been notified by its insurance carrier that the lawsuit filed by Ray Funderburk against the college's board of trustees has been settled for $265,000. You filed a lawsuit on June 2nd, 2023, against the Board of Trustees after they removed you from the board during a special meeting on March 8th, 2023. The college's insurance carrier informed the college that Funderburk has incurred $265,000 in legal fees and that Funderburk and the insurance company were willing to settle for that amount. The action was taken to resolve the matter efficiently and does not represent any admission of liability by the Board of Trustees or anyone at the college. What do you think about that statement?
It's an interesting spin that they put on the settlement. The settlement that I signed, the papers I signed, said nothing about lawyer fees. It said this is a settlement for me for the thing to end. So there obviously I think it's an attempt at saving some face. The insurance paid $265,000. Out of that, Gary got his fees, and I received money also.
Okay. So there's more to that. It wasn't just going off to your legal fees.
No. Well, I will say right here that Mr. Shipman deserved as much as he could get because he was an exceptional lawyer. And he has – that's the second time he's beaten the Cape Fear Community College trustees. And I was impressed by him, and – I am very happy with the settlement.
And let's – I mean, this was 3 years of your life, and going up to when they removed you, it was very tumultuous as well. I mean, it started even before you were on that board because the Board of Trustees and the college really wanted another trustee, Robbie Collins, but the school board put you on instead. But then, you know, there were a series of issues that you didn't see eye to eye with the college administration or the trustees. And then we had, you know, your hearing.
Yeah.
What has it been like for you?
Two things here. First, before I was sworn in, I had an inkling that things weren't what I thought they were. And it was, I think, the week before I was eating dinner, and I was called by the chair to urge me to vote for the raise that was being proposed for
former chair Bill Cherry.
Yeah.
He's still on the board.
Yeah, for Mr. Morton. He called me. But what raised my hackles and made me think really is Michelle Lee called and urged me to vote for.
And that's the chief of staff for
at
Morton.
The time, she was his executive assistant. And personally, I thought that was – I could see a fellow board member lobbying me to vote for the president's raise, but to have the executive assistant of the president, I didn't think that was appropriate. And that started my whole – my mind was whirling after that. And as you know, I voted against the raise, and they were not happy with that. And now in retrospect, after 3 years, one of the things that I had steeled myself for was to go to trial. I was ready to go to trial. It would have cost me money at that time. It was going to be more expensive, and we had discussed that. And I said, yeah, I'll figure out how to pay for this. I don't have a problem with that. But the trial would have exposed a lot of what I heard in depositions to the public.
And I want to back up a little bit. I mean, you speaking to me right now, there's nothing in your settlement that says that you can't speak against the college or share your experience.
Nothing in my settlement says I can't speak at all. No, I'm fine. I'm perfectly free to say what I – and I'll say –
Did your lawyer have to advocate for that?
He had to advocate. They wanted to put the insurance clause in the papers I signed, and I said – he said no and didn't do it. So it's a pretty clean, straightforward
But then they went back on that, did – with
well,
this statement, or
that's them trying to spin it. They can say anything they want, but that's not in the settlement that I signed at all. So it's kind of surprising.
Because what we're saying is the settlement was paid to you, and what?
Yes. And obviously, Mr. Shipman got the money he deserved, and I'm very happy with that.
And what was that process for the public? I mean, 3 years of your life going through this suit, you sat in on some depositions preparing for trial or?
We hadn't started preparing for trial, but I sat in on just about every deposition except two or maybe three. One, I was out of town and one and two others were very short. It was an education, first of all. And it also showed me the case that they had. Well, they didn't really make a case. My case was they had, in kicking me off the board, they had deprived me of my First Amendment rights to speak under North Carolina law and federal law, and they didn't follow their own rules in their bylaws or the state rules, and it was a quasi-judicial hearing, and they didn't give me fair due process. This was not about them calling me names. This was about them not following their own rules. It was very simple, and they did that surprisingly without any qualms at all. That's the way they did it. They wanted to get rid of me.
And it sounded like, reviewing the facts of the case, that they were building a case against you long before you knew that this was coming, that they were going for your removal. And they basically gave you 48 hours notice, and then...
Well, if anybody wants to see how strong my case was, I can look. I think it may be even on your archives. The whole hearing was recorded, and you can hear what they said and how they said it. In fact, there's a quote in there from the prosecutor, Jason
McLeod.
Mr. McLeod, he said, "I don't care what you said. I know what you were thinking," which is crazy. We're not a country that knows what people think. At least I don't. It surprised me, and that was one of his. That was one of the premises he had about getting rid of me.
And for the public, and we've made this clear, too, in our past reporting, that the case against you was that allegedly you were pressuring an instructor to change a high school student's grade so that he could be eligible for baseball, and that you spoke up during a Black student union forum when you shouldn't have. And that was their case, essentially.
That was their case. And they said that what I said at the Black student union thing was that I defamed the college, which I didn't. The other thing that they said is that I...
My understanding was that you're saying this was a great event. I wish more people would have come, including the media.
That's exactly what I said. I said, people need to know about this. Then that's what I said. It's interesting here. A lot of members of the board say, we want to run this like a business. In a business, you can fire somebody for saying something. It's no problem. It's a private business. You can't do that in a public university or any public positions because people have the right of free speech. That's the line there. And they thought they could do what they wanted to do when they wanted to do it. The second thing about me approaching the instructor about changing the grade, I didn't. I didn't say anything to him. And to the contrary, there is a recording out there that I'd like to get a hold of, and if I can get it to you, if it's okay for me to get it to you, of Mr. McLeod's discussion with the instructor. And in that, I can quote it nearly verbatim. The instructor says no. He didn't. He said he didn't care what the student got. He wanted to know about the process. That's not an accurate quote, but close. I have a transcription of that too. The instructor recorded the entire meeting with Mr. McLeod.
Because one of the reasons that is my understanding is that he was nervous being called in one-on-one with the vice chair, and he was not allowed to bring a supervisor in there to help him talk to the vice chair. But then they were also alleging that against you, that you were putting people instructor in an awkward position.
Yeah. And when I talked to the instructor, actually, there were about four or five other instructors around. It was in rec room, and there were four or five other people there. So I wasn't hiding or trying to do that surreptitiously. The instructor asked for his chair to come in with him, and McLeod said, no, we don't need that. We can't do that.
But the instructor did record that conversation.
So he recorded it instead, and there is a recording.
And it's my understanding, I mean, this was done by the Board of Trustees. Bill Cherry was the head, and Jason McLeod is the vice chair. They're both still on the board. But they did this investigation with the help of Morton and his administration.
I can't speak to that. I don't know. I suspect that may be part of the deal.
In these depositions, I've seen some of them. We have Vice President Brandon Guthrie talking to the instructor, talking about, did Ray Funderburk do this, is my understanding.
I think Mr. Guthrie was one of the investigators that the instructor referenced, and I think Lynn Criswell also referenced that. She said that to me.
Yeah, because she also said that the instructor was taken aback, but there was no request to change any grade because you wanted to talk about, and I've actually done some reporting on this, the high school student population has exploded in the community college system and at CFCC. I mean, more and more high school students are taking these classes, and you are trying to understand that new trend.
Not only trying to understand, I'd been on the other side of that. I had been a high school teacher. And when my students in my homeroom or students that I were teaching kind of disappeared into the Cape Fear process, I didn't get a lot of feedback. And as I said in the letter that I wrote the board after the school board after I was put off the other one, there's got to be something. If you're teaching in a school, you get input from other teachers, get input from coaches, get input from vice principals, counselors about how students are doing. And the whole thing is built to help students do better. When I was teaching, they disappeared into Cape Fear, and then you got a grade at the end of the semester. And that's not the way high school kids are used to getting grades. And I wanted more communications. I wanted a better procedure. And I suspect that it has changed. And maybe because of me, I'm not going to claim that. I talked to some of my old teacher friends, and they said actually now they get midterm grades and things like that, which is necessary. High school kids are different from college kids.
I watched the hearing, your hearing in March of 2023. One of the points was also that you are not allowed to talk to staff. The only person you are essentially allowed to talk to was President Jim Morton, is what I heard come from the other trustees' mouths.
The trustees said that as a trustee, the only people that I could talk to were Michelle Lee and Jim Morton, and that I should take what they say, and they will investigate and give me the answers. And personally, I don't believe that should be. I believe you should be able to talk to anybody, and I believe to understand how a system is working. One of the things I wanted to do before I left, one of the last things that I proposed that was shut down real quick, was to have a third-party atmosphere survey of the teachers. And they haven't had one in a long, long time.
Yeah, they have not done that.
I wanted to see it because the only thing we knew is what Michelle Lee and the president told us, and I would have liked to seen more as a trustee. Sadly, I'm not a trustee anymore.
And I did reach out to the system for comment because they did ultimately, their legal team gave the green light to this hearing, and they have not responded.
I don't know. Community colleges are a necessary part of the state, but like any other thing, you get a lot of bureaucracy built up, and people in power like to stay in power and do what they want to do.
All right, well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment with more of my colleague Rachel Keith's interview with Ray Funderburk, a former CFCC trustee who recently settled with the college over the decision to remove him from office. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to the newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. We're headed back now to my colleague Rachel Keith's interview with Ray Funderburk, a former CFCC trustee who recently settled with the college over their decision to remove him from office.
Throughout your short tenure, and then when you wanted to be on this board, I mean, you had talked to some staff and faculty that were afraid and that they felt like they could come to you because you would actually listen to them and not dismiss them, and that there was going to be some form of retaliation for bringing up criticisms. I mean, what was that like, talking to faculty and staff on the college campus?
A number of faculty talked to me, and they all started the conversations, "Don't tell anybody I'm talking to you," because they were afraid. Community college instructors, community college professors have no protection. There is no tenure. There is no long term. If they have a president or any kind of supervisor who is vindictive, they won't last. They'll lose their job. And I am in great sympathy for them. There is no protection for them under any conditions.
So you did hear that, but
all the time.
And in our reporting, we have also heard that there are many people that will not go on the record because of that fact, that they've seen what has happened in the past to people who have been outspoken and the reality of that year-to-year contract.
Yeah.
And you said that the college's lawyer, Ken Gray, he sat in on some of these depositions, and he was even deposed himself, is my understanding.
Yes, he was deposed, and he was at every deposition that I sat in on, and he was also there for our mediation. There was a mediation last June that didn't work out, and he was there for the entire time. Most depositions took 8 to 10 hours. Some of them you had to come back for. The mediation took 8 to 10 hours, so they were lengthy affairs. I suspect he was on the payroll the whole time. That's one of the things the college is trying to show in its press release. We didn't pay for this. Our insurance company did, but they do pay insurance company rates, and they do pay Mr. Gray. I don't think he did that gratis.
And again, for the public, it's hard to understand that they do have their representation through Ken Gray, through Warden Smith, but then there was another law firm represented the insurance company.
Yes, it was a different law firm that represented the insurance company.
And I wanted to go back to the college. This action was taken to resolve that matter efficiently and does not represent any admission of liability by the Board of Trustees or anyone at the college.
That's a pretty standard release.
Well, what do you think?
It's $265,000 worth of no liability for the college. It's pretty obvious. I mean, if you want to see that part of it, they paid to stop it. And I'm sure someone in the college okayed the settlement. I don't think it would have gone forward without it. I mean, I had to okay my part of the settlement, not the lawyers. So I suspect someone in the college had to okay that. And that means I don't know if they felt they had that stronger case.
And let's go back to the decision. I mean, it was hard. It sounds like the mediation, they wanted to maybe settle, but lower. You still wanted the trial. Yeah, walk the public through.
We went back and forth on the mediation. A mediation, if you've never done one, which I'd never done, was fascinating. There's a mediator who goes back and forth. You start in one room, and everybody says their piece, and then they go back and forth. And the mediation, you sign papers that the mediation doesn't count in trial or anything else. It's just the attempt to mediate it. It was a good process. It just, we did not come to an agreement. They didn't meet our limits, and so that was fine. And when you leave that, we went on to depose Mr. Gray after that. So
yeah,
it was as we were preparing, or Gary was preparing to go to trial.
And the trial, I mean, that would have brought it all out into the public square. There is some degree of that with us talking right now. But walk us through that decision. It was just the time, the money, they were willing to come to an agreement.
It was 3 years. That was the decision. I had set in my mind, and I told Gary this, I had set that if trial comes, that'll be what we do. And I think the genesis of my decision was, this is what's going on in the country now. Powerful people are saying, we can do this because we can do this. They're not following rules. They're not following due process. Their First Amendment is getting trampled on. And personally, I didn't think they should be able to do it. And it was difficult. It was difficult because I going to trial, I would have had to help and pay for a good bit of that preparation. And that's tough. But I was firm in my belief in two things. This was the right thing to do. And I had an excellent attorney representing me. And those two things, I was ready to go forward.
And I mean, this is 3.5 years of your life. I mean, what have you learned something new about yourself through going through this?
I have learned that I'm probably more stubborn than I ever thought I was, and I was pretty stubborn to begin with. I think also what I've learned is there's a lot of people out there who are helping kids and doing the right thing, and they don't get a fair shake. And I saw that at Cape Fear Community College. And as a former teacher, seeing what's going on in public education in the state now is horrible. And people are just doing it because they can get away with it.
Are you talking about in terms of funding?
Funding, support, name it. It amazes me. And standing up is hard for people. I was lucky. I was retired. I had some money to put toward it. And I was in a position where I could. Everybody's not in that position. And people are still doing it. I have no doubt things are going on at public and institutions where they're taking advantage of people because they know they can.
What did you learn about the college through this process, too, or the trustees?
There are three levels here, the trustees. And what I realized after it, the trustees are just there to sit in monthly meetings and get it on their resume. I didn't see a whole lot of desire among them to question or think about what was going on, question the president at a minimum. And that surprised me. I learned also there's probably a lot of good lower staff members at that college who do the work to keep things running. And what it seems to me is that the president has built almost a praetorian guard of people he's appointed in higher positions. And every bit of extra money, the state gives a salary schedule. I know. I was a public school teacher. They do that for the community colleges and for the president and everything else. I think the president's schedule is about $170,000 a year. I don't know.
Somewhere it's 183 is my last that I looked at.
That means over $200,000 is being paid by New Hanover County. And if you're a trustee, you're responsible for that. I think Michelle Lee's salary is well above what is appropriate.
It's $186,000 last time I checked. So.
And I think that's well above what the state appropriates for her position. So the county pays that. We should be careful with the county's money. If that money was in the budget, it might help public schools a lot. And what you said earlier about Cape Fear Community College as now a great thing for public schools because they don't have enough money, so they put, 10% of students or more than that, 20% of students in Cape Fear classes? I'm not sure.
I think it was 14% okay. I looked.
Think about that. That saves the county money, and it also, those are contact hours that the state pays Cape Fear Community College for. Now, that should be a good relationship, and I'm not against anything like that. So, yeah. It made me look at the whole system. The interesting thing that happened since then is the legislature now appoints trustees, and they don't know anything about
a majority.
Yeah. They don't know anything about the county.
Well, when we asked Michael Lee this question, Senator Michael Lee, who's one of the people that have influence over the appointees, that he was closer to this community than the governor was.
They took it completely away from the Board of Education. Which probably has.
And they did take it away from the governor.
Yeah.
As
and
well.
That's the Board of Education has a vested interest if you've got that many students in the system. So I think the whole thing needs a hard look and probably change.
Do you feel like this settlement vindicates you and what they accused you of?
Yes.
They say that obviously in their statement that. This does not represent any liability on their part, but.
Yeah, that's boilerplate, and I understand that. And that's what they're going to say. But I feel vindicated, but I also feel that I brought some attention to it. And I don't know if that helped or it didn't, but bringing attention to problems is necessary.
Were you confident that you were going to ultimately either get this settlement money or it would go to trial and you would be on the right side of all of this?
I was confident all along that I was on the right side. I was absolutely confident. I did not. It was the way things should be.
And it was not unanimous for the vote to remove you. We have former trustees Jonathan Barfield, Dolores Rhodes, and Deborah Dix Maxwell who sat in that hearing with you, and they were not convinced whatsoever. But their other colleagues were absolutely convinced that they were right.
I don't know if they were convinced. They were going along with what the people said. Jonathan Barfield predicted this in the hearing. People can listen to it. He said, this is terrible. There's going to be a lawsuit, and we're going to pay out. Now, they didn't pay out directly. Their insurance company paid out, but there were hours billed by Ken Gray for the whole thing.
And it's plausible that their insurance rates might increase because of this.
Happens with my car insurance, so I'm not sure if they want to make money. Their insurance rates should be up. They've settled a couple times before. Gary has been their nemesis for a long while now. And as long as they do silly stuff and people have the courage to step up, I think he will continue to be.
And that courage, again, it takes support, financial support, legal support that you can count on, and the willingness to play the long game.
Yeah, that's the tough thing. I'm glad it's over. I think Cape Fear Community College, as I was talking earlier, there's three parts of it. There's the trustees, and I don't really know how they're connected because I didn't see them do a whole lot except shovel money to Mr. Morton. There are staff members who do a lot of work. When I toured the college, the first thing I was amazed. There are people who run the boats. There are people in just keep it running. And there are faculty there who do a great job both on the academic side, teaching math, English, and on the trade side. That's a wonderful institution, and I just think it deserves better.
What's next for you now that you've shut the door on this?
Yeah. I would like to write about it just as and I don't know what I'd do with it, but I was an English teacher and English major, and I want to organize my thoughts about it. I've been keeping notes on it for a long time, and it's a cautionary tale. It really is. Our system is set up, ideally, if it works, that citizens become board members for a while and go off the board, and that should cover most citizens. But if you look at the boards in New Hanover County, that's the other thing this did to me. I started looking at pictures of people on the boards. The same people are on all the boards, the ABC board, the airport board, the trustees, and we should mix people around. There are a lot of people in this county who could probably do well on those boards and offer new ideas. And those boards should not be decorations or additions to resumes. They should be active boards that question and do the right thing.
And you mentioned cautionary tale. Is it a cautionary tale about power? Is it a cautionary tale about how people do things to support that power structure? Well, what's the tale?
The cautionary tale to me is that when you get a number of people together to control something and they start believing they can do what they want when they want. For instance, before me, they got rid of Jimmy Hopkins. I'm not going to say whether that was right or wrong as far as Mr. Hopkins' attendance.
For the record, they were blaming it on Julia Olson Bozeman.
Yes.
That did the main removal, that they didn't do it. She did.
That, to me, was completely against. I researched the bylaws. I talked to other people.
And there were other absences from the other trustees that did not get the same.
And to me, if we had had a meeting, a hearing, and voted on it the proper way, then that would have been his day in court. Just to remove him because someone on the county commission said we can remove him?
But someone gave him that information to do that because from our reporting, Jimmy Hopkins was against the Bank of America building for the nursing program, or he had questions about it, whatever his intentions were.
Yeah.
But he made the wrong move. He upset the apple cart, and then that was his end of his time.
But still,
and they found a legitimate, according to them, excuse to do so.
There's a lot of questions about that.
But I was looking on your social media when you got removed. You had a lot of support, and now 3 years later, you have told the public as well that it's out there in the news.
Yeah.
WECT, WHQR, Port City Daily, WWAY. We have informed the public that you did get that settlement. And so what has been the response to that?
Only two things. I received a lot of support from friends, ex-students, former students, and I want to thank them during the time that this went on and recently. And I think that response has been overwhelming to me. And they were all the same people who, when this happened the first time, who were telling me, you know, you didn't do this, we're upset for you. And now they've come back and saying, you deserved it, this is right. And that, when you talk about vindication, that makes me feel good. You do things for the few people that you try to help, and that's it. And that's good.
Well, Ray Funderburk, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment with my colleague Kelly Kinnoyer as she sits down with UNCW economist Mohsin Ghatabi to get his take on the impact of a toll bridge over the Cape Fear River. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. 5 years ago, the Wilmington area was hit with a jarring proposition. Due to declining state transportation funding, the only way to replace the aging Cape Fear Memorial Bridge might be with a toll. The idea was wildly unpopular, and initially it was shot down. But it kept coming back, though state officials would often tell local leaders to, quote, trust the process. They were implying, in short, that if we kept the toll idea on the table, the project would seem more viable and could eventually win enough grant funding to make the toll unnecessary. That's been called a shell game, a boondoggle, a Hail Mary, and the least worst option. But it kept at least some hope alive for years. Now, after an on-again, off-again, on-again $250 million federal grant, the bridge's increasing cost has still continued to rise, apparently far above the state's ability to pay for it. With a price tag now well over $1 billion, it's become increasingly likely that a toll bridge will be the only way the Cape Fear Memorial gets replaced. So, setting aside the politics for now, we wanted to explore the question, what does that mean for the Cape Fear region in economic terms? It turns out that's a perfect question for UNCW's regional economist Mohsin Ghatabi, who agreed to sit down with my colleague Kelly Kinnoyer and dig into the potential impacts of a toll bridge.
I'm here with Mohsin Ghatabi, the regional economist for UNCW. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we are here to talk about the infamous toll bridge, and I am just very curious about all of the economic impacts that this bridge could potentially have on Wilmington, on the surrounding region, on individual workers who are trying to make use of the infrastructure we have in town. So let's start pretty broad. Let's just talk about if we put a toll bridge in, what will the economic impact be on the city of Wilmington and on New Hanover County?
Yeah, it's a great place to start. I think that unambiguously, if there is a tolling option, the first thing that will happen is that there will be less traffic going towards Leland on a daily basis because people are going to respond to the additional costs that will be incurred. That means potentially living on the other side of the bridge becomes at the margin less attractive because you're bearing an additional $1,000 a year in additional expenditures. So one way to think about it is right now, an argument is a lot of lower wage workers are choosing to live in Brunswick County because rent is cheaper. So by how much cheaper is rent currently there? And does tolling potentially influence that differential, right? And so if the additional costs of paying for the toll exceed whatever savings you're incurring right now, that may push more people to choose to live inside New Hanover County. So at the margin, land or rents are probably going to go up inside New Hanover County because people are going to be choosing to avoid paying for the toll. Again, using the same logic, just on the other side of the bridge, at the margin, rent becomes a little bit less attractive in Brunswick County. Now, those are what I think about as first order effects, if you will. there is secondary effects. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I'll note there is we've talked about how a third of the workforce in New Hanover County is commuting in from outside of New Hanover County. Yeah. And I guess it sounds like what might happen is a consolidation of the population growth into the city of Wilmington and into New Hanover County, even though we're right now seeing politicians pushing back on that kind of growth. So, I mean, I guess I'm wondering if it's going to be damaging economically in that respect.
I hesitate to say damaging, but yes, the behavioral effects certainly do point towards this consolidation because people are going to be trying to avoid paying for those tolls. Now, whether or not we have the space, whether or not we have the desire to build the type of housing that would accommodate individuals is a different question. But there is no doubt that it undoubtedly makes living in Brunswick County more expensive. Therefore, anybody that's doing the math, and as you said, there is considerable commuting, is going to be thinking about being inside of New Hanover County and therefore trying to avoid the toll.
So I'm curious if there could be some kind of benefit to Leland or if you think it's just going to push down rents and push down economic growth there. Because I know that Leland has pushed a lot for more commercial activity on that side of the river. Yeah. So what do you expect that'll be?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question because there are effects going both directions, right? And so we just talked about people potentially not wanting to reside in Leland anymore because it's going to be more expensive. On the other hand, if you're somebody that currently lives in Leland and shops in Wilmington, you're going to be incurring that additional expenditure. So it may make, at the margin, Leland think harder about putting in more shops, more restaurants to potentially maintain some of the leakage that currently comes towards New Hanover County. And so I think it'll be interesting to see both how responsive are individuals in terms of these relocation decisions and whether or not local governments, developers respond to potentially meet these changing demands of residents in Leland.
Well, do you think that there's enough going on in Leland that it can sustain its own economy in that respect?
There is certainly a lot of money, right? And so we've talked in the past about the injection of money that has entered Brunswick County as a county just from migration alone. So somewhere close to $500 million a year from migration income has entered that area. So there is no doubt that there is a growing population. Most forecasts show that the growth will continue. Can they sustain all sorts of shopping that we have in New Hanover County? The answer is likely no. Can they potentially have additional things, especially now that the cost of coming over will be higher? I think the answer is yes. So I think that it certainly will be, again, I keep using at the margin, because while these are important costs, clearly if you're a commercial developer, you're thinking about, as you said, demand, you're thinking about where you are, and this is one of the many factors that you're considering. But I think at the margin, it could make it more attractive to put something inside of Leland, because now that cost differential becomes a determining question in where people shop and or spend money.
We had talked about the impact on land value and on rents in New Hanover County. Do you think that as rents go up and land value goes up in New Hanover, we'll see it drop in Brunswick County?
Yeah, I mean, I think that so most of the academic work is fairly consistent that almost immediately once something like this goes into effect, there is what's referred to as the sorting effect, right? And so people sort into places that make sense. And so I think you'll see this fairly a quick jump in rents inside New Hanover, probably a small drop outside of New Hanover or into Brunswick. And then with time, you see people now starting to adapt, right? And so is there more development that's happening in Brunswick? Does the drop in rent in Brunswick County potentially start to compensate for the expenditure in terms of tolling? And so I think that there are short-term effects and then there are long-term effects, but there is no doubt that it shifts economic activity over the next, decade plus.
I mean, you said it would be $1,000 a year. Yeah. So that's a pretty substantial amount.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, think about it. Like the numbers that are being floated around are $2, right? And so $2, that means $4 a day. That means, you know, you're paying, you know, $20 a week. And so that obviously multiplies fairly quickly. So.
Hmm. I want to also ask about traffic because I live on the north side and I'm near the other bridge, which will not be told. So this is personal for me. Yeah. I remember when the bridge in question went down for construction, we were backed up all the way to Market Street from on 5th and on 3rd Street. So it was chaotic. And I'm wondering if you expect to see probably not that extreme of a situation, but a lot of people kind of filtering to the northern end of town to go over the other bridge because of that economic pressure.
Unambiguously, right? And so traffic diversion has been found in just about every situation where we've had some form of tolling, because some people are going to choose to avoid the toll, and therefore they're going to be looking for alternative routes. It doesn't mean, like you said, that we're going to be backed up the way we were when there was the temporary shock. But I think that you do not anticipate that the number of cars in Wilmington, the metro, is just going to shrink overnight, right? And so if people, behavioral econ tells us, obviously some people are going to choose to avoid the bridge that is tolled, and therefore they're going to be seeking other alternatives. For some people, the toll is really attractive, because if you're a high income earner and sitting in traffic for an hour costs you $400 an hour, paying $4 is actually a huge improvement in quality of life, right? And so I would say yes to your question of traffic diversion, but it's not going to be we're not going to have a toll bridge that's completely empty and everybody seeking alternative routes.
One thing that we've talked about a little bit off mic is this idea that having a toll might actually decrease the overall amount of congestion. Do you expect that that's going to be true across the board or just in that part of town?
Probably more pronounced in that part of the town, right? And so I think that the thing that we know is the bridge has been a significant bottleneck, right? And so if we reduce congestion there, I think that, yes, it will divert traffic to other places, but I think it will improve the flow of traffic in general, because people are going to be thinking more closely about times of arrival, when they go out, which routes they choose. And so rather than just having this kind of significant through line between New Hanover and Brunswick. So I think net-net, whether it's Tokyo, London, or Stockholm, most city, large cities have found fairly significant declines in congestion or times waiting. That has obviously a value, because obviously time has value, but also there's been benefit from pollution reduction, because we just have cars sitting around for 45 minutes doing nothing.
Well, that'll cheer up the environmentalists at least.
Yeah.
I'm curious. So we had talked about the folks who are deterred by the toll entirely and might choose to take the other bridge. These are folks who $4 a day makes a big difference. And I think that realistically, we're talking about service workers. A lot of these folks currently are choosing Brunswick County because of that lower cost of living, because of the rent. What's going to be the impact for businesses that are hiring these low-wage workers?
Yeah, I think that that's probably the most whenever you think about tolling, I think the equity concerns or distributional concerns are probably the most pronounced ones, because tolling tends to be regressive, meaning while the amount that we pay is the same, as a share of income, that $4 is a much higher share of income for a low-wage worker than a high-wage worker. So to answer your question, the solutions then become, do you address the housing needs inside of New Hanover County and tackle them directly by building affordable housing, or by building more multifamily housing and then benefiting from filtering, or thinking about it directly, or do you subsidize The toll, obviously, that's something that whenever we had that temporary closure, do you move to some sort of remote work for service workers? That's not necessarily something that makes sense. Or you're going to start seeing increases in prices for the goods and services that we consume. Because if you're a restaurant and you want to help your worker pay for that bridge toll, then that may end up showing up in your check for whatever things that you consume. So, yeah, so I think it's a non-negligible question. And like I said, the equity and or distributional concerns are non-negligible and worth thinking about. And as we've said before, the question of discounts are off the table if it's state funded. And so,
yeah, I mean, one thing that I'll just point out is I think for a lot of folks who are working in the service industry, housing is a real struggle. I mean, there's been a lot of times when I interview somebody who's literally homeless and they'll talk about their job working in a kitchen downtown. And so I'm wondering if we're going to see those pressures leading to people staying in their cars, things like that, just so they can stay in New Hanover County and not deal with the toll, make ends meet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is no doubt that there are going to be consequences. I think to me, the best way to deal with this is to think about those downstream effects and try to mitigate them the best way possible. So if there is a public-private partnership to offer significant discounts to low-wage workers, or to think about subsidies, or to think about alternative ways to shelter individuals who are most vulnerable, and Wilmington has clearly a robust leisure and hospitality sector that has already struggled over the last couple of years with the increase in cost of living in attracting and retaining workers, this would potentially exacerbate it. I don't think it's a reason to not do it. I think it's an important thing that should be at the table to think about when you're thinking about how does this play out.
Yeah, I think that that's worth really outlining here. In terms of how we actually build this bridge, there's basically two options for funding a toll bridge. Yeah. And one of them is for NCDOT to fund it in its entirety alongside other government partners in the federal government. And the other is for it to be a public-private partnership where a company comes in, builds the toll, and takes the profits from it. And the latter permits that kind of discounting, and the former does not. If it's a government bridge, they are not allowed to do discounts for people. If it were a private entity, it could be that they give New Hanover County residents or Brunswick County residents a break on the toll, or specifically people based on income, or if they're retirees. So those are ways that they can play with this. And I think that it wouldn't necessarily be out of the goodness of the company's heart. It could be something built into the contract, right?
Absolutely. I think that, again, this is why I say these distributional concerns need to be part of the overall discussion, because the consequences are unavoidable. But what you can do is think about revenue recycling, think about discounts, think about who bears the burden of these additional costs. How does it shift the attractiveness of New Hanover County? How does it shift the attractiveness of the area in general, and does it make at the margin attracting and retaining workers, especially in certain sectors, harder or easier? And what are the things at the table that we can do to mitigate those concerns?
I think my last real question on this is just the cost of this bridge, because I recall when we sought this federal grant that's like $240-something million, that was supposed to be half of the cost of this bridge. And now this is a $1 billion bridge. So that happened in the course of a few years. So what are we looking at here? If we don't have a plan currently, is this bridge just going to keep getting more and more and more expensive? Are we looking at a $2 billion bridge if we don't build it soon? What are we looking at?
Yeah, I think waiting is costly. This is what this really teaches us. Not that this is a lesson that people don't know, but there are real costs associated with doing nothing. And inflation's been raging. Obviously, cost of materials have increased quite significantly. And I think that waiting potentially makes the feasibility even more difficult, makes this project penciling out even more difficult. And obviously, the growth of the area continues to put pressure on the bridge, the port's growth, the airport's growth. So more traffic, more people. I think that it would behoove us to address it sooner rather than later, both from a quality of life standpoint, but also from a cost consideration.
Is there anything else we didn't get to on this?
I think that it's just infrastructure is so incredibly important, right? And so, and that's really ultimately what we're talking about. And I think that there are people who feel very, very strongly about opposing a toll, and I completely understand it. But I think that there are ways, as we've discussed, to potentially mitigate the negative consequences. And whenever there are these big questions in economics, it's who pays and how do I potentially minimize the burden on the subset of individuals who pay? Because what we want to ultimately try to do is to minimize these behavioral responses. If we don't want too many people to shift where they live, or we don't want the restaurant downtown to start struggling to hire somebody, we want to be thinking about, okay, we impose a cost. That cost makes it more expensive to live in Brunswick County. Does this worker now move to Pender? Do they just leave the area altogether? And what can we do to ensure that we not eliminate, but mitigate some of these costs?
All right, Mohsin Ghatabi, the regional economist for UNCW. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode. Thanks to our guests, Ray Funderburk and Mohsin Ghatabi, and my colleagues, Rachel Keith and Kelly Kinoyer, along with WHQR program director Ken Campbell for technical support. Music for today's show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have questions, comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.